Hello, you're listening to Microbe Talk, the podcast from the Microbiology Society. This episode, we've got an hour-long special on the topic of antibiotic resistance. Now, earlier this month, we went along to New Scientist Live, a giant exhibition of science and technology at the Excel Centre in London. At the exhibition, the Microbiology Society organised a panel discussion, together with the Biochemical Society, called When a Scratch Can Kill, about the looming threat of antibiotic resistance and what's being done to fight back. It was a really great event delivered to a packed out audience, and between them the panellists gave a fantastic primer on the issue of antibiotic resistance, why it's so important that we act now, and what we can do to stop it. And I really do mean we. As you'll hear, it's not just government and scientists and industry that have a role to play, it's all of us. I'll hand you over now to Professor Laura Bowater, who is chairing the event.
I'd just like to welcome you all today to this session. So as I was announced, I'm Laura Bowater. I'm a professor at the Norwich Medical School, and I have got a passion for antibiotics and antibiotic resistance. I started to be interested in this topic in the early 1990s when I was working as a scientist in the John Innes Centre researching new antibiotics. And it was about that time that scientists started to realise that we might have a problem on our hands. But we probably weren't that good at telling people about it. And as you can know, and why you're here, is you've probably started to get the message now that actually antibiotic resistance might be a problem, and it might be something that as society, not just the scientists or the doctors, we all have to work together to fix this problem actually. So I'd just like to welcome to the stage all my speakers who are going to take you through their different perspectives. So I've got Caroline, who's a clinician, and I work with Caroline in Norwich. We've also got Tamar, who is here as well. So she's working on the Longitude Prize, which is hoping to find a solution. And we've got Anthony, who's been doing lots of work with the government to try and find a pathway forward for this talk. So first of all, how we're going to start off the session is with Caroline, who's going to be giving the clinician's perspective about whether there really is an issue going on at the moment. Caroline?
Okay, I'm, as well as being a lecturer at the medical school and doing infection research, my day job is as a consultant medical microbiologist within the NHS. So in the past 30 years, I've spent every working day of my life looking at diagnosing, treating, and trying to prevent infections. So what I want to do today is talk a little bit of how my working life and life for my patients has changed, where we're going, and the impact of antimicrobial resistance on my job, and more importantly, my patients. Okay, so modern medicine. I know the title of the session is When a Scratch Can Kill, but actually, before we get to the stage of scratches killing, we've got to think of the big role that antibiotics play in our current medical practice. Most of our acute surgical procedures, we need antibiotics for, either to treat patients that have got an infection, for example, if you have appendicitis or peritonitis, or to prevent infection. So if we're operating on the gut, where we know there's a lot of microbes, we will give antibiotics to try and prevent people from getting infections because of their surgery. So without using antibiotics, a lot of these procedures wouldn't be successful. And then the second thing up there is spare part surgery. Now, we do a lot of things for our patients where we take out diseased parts of the body and replace them. We can do living organ transplants, cadaver transplants, so organs from dead donors. And those patients, in order to stop them from having rejection, we have to suppress their immune systems. And when your immune system is suppressed, you're likely to get an infection. So we need antibiotics to protect these patients too. Even joint replacements. So you'd think that's fairly straightforward. It's clean. You wouldn't expect many organisms to infect an artificial joint. But our skin organisms can actually stick to the metal and plastic of artificial joints, and they grow very, very slowly. So you don't get a killer infection, but over the space of some years, you can end up with a sticky film of bacteria in the space between the artificial joint and your muscles and tissues, and that can cause the joint to fail. So you end up with your patients getting a very, very painful joint, which may need to be removed completely. And if the infection is very severe, we can't put a new one back in. So we have to cover all these replacement surgeries with antibiotics to stop the organisms from getting in. So we are dependent on antibiotics for these to be successful procedures. Also, with our cancer patients and with other patients who need treatment that will impair their immune system, we have to rely on antibiotics. If you're having cancer treatment, you're very prone to infection, and because you can't fight the infection yourself, we have to hit you hard and hit you quickly with very powerful antibiotics, otherwise you may die. Similarly, with a lot of patients who have things like arthritis, we're increasingly using antibiotics and biological compounds that suppress the immune system to stop your disease from getting worse. So again, you're very prone to infections. A lot of the common biological therapies we use, for example, for rheumatoid arthritis, leave you prone to getting tuberculosis. And a lot of people carry tuberculosis in their body, and then when they're immunosuppressed, it comes back out. So we need good, effective antibiotics that are going to treat these people before they become ill. Then, when you look at our patient population, particularly, say, intensive care patients, they've got bits of plastic going into where bits of plastic aren't designed to go. So we end up with people ventilating them with tubes, with them having intravenous drips, with them having urinary catheters, and all these plastic devices are susceptible to getting colonized with bacteria. And obviously then you have a direct route from the outside in to your body. So everybody who has something like a ventilator or an intravenous line is prone to infection. And we need good anti-infectives to help keep them alive. So when we start seeing problems with resistant bacteria, it means that these patients are very much endangered. If you have a respiratory infection, so if you have a chest infection when you're intubated and you have a multi-resistant organism, it's very difficult to treat, and these are patients who are very ill in the first place. So what I've seen in the last 30 years is I'm dealing with more and more resistant organisms. So I started off with in the 1980s with just a few patients having multi-drug resistant infections, and now I'm seeing them on a daily basis. In the last week in the hospital, I've been dealing with one patient with multi-drug resistant tuberculosis, several patients with multi-drug resistant urinary tract infections, and a patient on ITU with a very, very nasty bug in their chest. I've also been dealing with very nasty resistant organisms in some of our cystic fibrosis patients. And these are things that I would not have seen a few years ago. Now, we know that we can prevent some of these. The big killer diseases we've prevented with public health measures, such as better housing, better nutrition, better clean water supplies, and also with immunization. So we don't see diphtheria. We don't see whooping cough. We've dealt with that. But there are other things that we've seen in the last few years. MRSA, which I suspect most of you have heard about, is a variant of a common skin organism called Staph aureus. The thing about MRSA is that it's resistant to our first-line antibiotics. Now, we've got the number of infections with this right down to very low levels now because we've been made very aware of it. So we now screen patients to see if they're carrying MRSA. We do infection control in our hospitals and in our community to stop MRSA spreading from patient to patient. And if a patient is coming in for a high-risk procedure, we will treat them in advance of their surgery to try and get rid of the MRSA so they're no longer at risk. So we know that if we jump in early, we can reduce the risk. So we're pretty much on top of that. But what's more worrying for me is the things that are coming up now. We have a problem with gut organisms. The organisms that live in our gut share their genes very easily. So they can transfer antibiotic resistance genes between one another. Now, the most common things we see with multi-drug resistant, including two particular sorts of enzyme that actually break down the antibiotics, this is ESBL and CPE, are E. coli and Klebsiella. Now, E. coli and Klebsiella are important parts of our microbiome, okay? The microbiome is the complex community of gut organisms that every single one of us has. Now, the more we know about this community, the more important we think it is. There have been research papers that looking at the effects of our gut saying that if it's unbalanced, then we can be more prone to obesity, more prone to diabetes. We know it's pretty essential for immune functioning. And also some vitamins are made by the organisms in our gut. So if we start using more and more powerful antibiotics to get rid of these resistant organisms, then we're actually endangering our whole gut health and our whole body. So, what do I need? Well, in my armamentarium, I need new drugs. We're running out of effective antibiotics. Maybe we should look at different ways of killing bacteria. Perhaps we could use phages, which are viruses that preferentially infect bacteria. Maybe instead of looking at killing bacteria, we should just look at stopping them from producing all the poisons that cause the disease process. There's a lot of things out there that we can look at. So we need them working a different way. It's also essential, because of our microbiome, to keep the good organisms, keep the healthy gut flora going whilst killing the bad ones. I want antibiotics that are going to kill the germs but aren't going to damage my patients. And when we have the patients with the really resistant organisms, we are ending up using more and more toxic antibiotics. So for MRSA, the main organism we use in hospitals to treat this is actually very toxic to our kidneys. So we can end up with patients with renal failure. And the last on my list is, if you're going to give me a new antibiotic, I'd like it to be cheap, please, because we are, like it or not, a publicly funded health service, free at the point of delivery. And if an antibiotic course is going to cost £30,000, that's the same cost as employing a nurse for a year, employing one of my lab technicians for a year. So the search for new antibiotics is important, but I've got a big list of things I want. And I'm going to hand over now to Anthony, who can maybe tell us a little bit about where we're going with this.
So my name's Anthony MacDonald, and I am the head of economic research on the Independent Review into Antimicrobial Resistance, more colloquially known as the O'Neill Review. And we were set up a little over 2 years ago by then Prime Minister David Cameron, who talked about, if we don't solve antibiotics crisis, we're going to end up in the dark age of medicine once again, because things like, as we've just heard, cancer treatments are unlikely to work, where people will become sick much more easily. And so he appointed an economist, my chairman, Jim O'Neill. And you're probably wondering, why am I listening to an economist, and why did the government appoint an economist to deal with what is a health problem? And our role was simple, how to reduce demand, unnecessary use of antibiotics, and how to increase the supply of new ones, which are in many ways quite fundamentally economic questions, and particularly what role should government do? So, the first thing we did after we were set up is we tried to ask the question, what will really happen if drugs stop working? And it's something that there was very little research on. We all know that we rely heavily on antibiotics. We don't want to go back to the days when 2/3 of pensioners die when they get pneumonia, or where you can't have good cancer treatments or organ transplants. But what would it actually mean? And so we hired KPMG and Rand, two modelers, to estimate what a world would look like if antibiotics started to fail consistently. And they looked at what would happen if three quite standard antibiotics, sorry, bacteria, MRSA, Klebsiella pneumoniae, and E. coli, I don't expect you to remember the names, become resistant to antibiotics, as well as malaria, tuberculosis, and HIV becoming resistant to their treatments. And they looked at what happens if resistance would rise to 40%, which is about the same level as much of the resistance is to E. coli in India, or is to Klebsiella pneumoniae in Greece and India. So these were not scary rates. These are what happens if the whole world has similar rates of resistance to India and Greece have right now. And with this, they created a model. And to quote George Box, all models are wrong, but some models are useful. And our model was certainly wrong in predicting this. But it, as we are the first people to do it, I can also assure you it was the best model that's ever done it. And they found that if we took the same mortality rates for every person who had a resistant infection today to 2050, and if 40% of people instead of 1% or 2% of people have resistant infections, the number of people in the world dying from resistant infections will go from about 700,000 people at the moment to 10 million people dying every year. And the first thing to note is that 700,000 people are dying from an illness that we often ignore and don't know very much about, but that rate will increase hugely as long as people don't have access to drugs that they need to make them sick. And that rate, it's bigger than cancer. It's 4 or 5 times the size of road accidents, more even, and diarrheal diseases. And so this will be a huge problem if we don't sort it out. And it will be a huge problem everywhere. Like so many things, Africa is the most adversely affected, we found in our model. But across Europe and North America, you can see over the next 35 years, we're likely to see tenfold increases in drug-resistant infection deaths unless we do something to solve it. So the second part of our job was, well, how do you solve it? And I'll just quickly run through kind of our 10 solutions that we put out in a report last May. The first one is we need public awareness. People need to wash their hands more, not demand antibiotics from their doctor when they have a cold. Know that they should drink clean water if they live in countries where that is a problem. The second thing we need is sanitation and hygiene. We need to build sewage systems throughout India and much of the low and middle income the world, so that people have clean water supplies and so that people have proper sewage systems. And this would hugely reduce infection rates, which would then reduce the need for antibiotics and stop people getting sick. We need to invest in human capital and train doctors to be better and nurses to be better at spotting resistant infections and so that doctors have a better understanding of drug resistance. Today, we often think of bacterial and infectious disease as being something from the early 20th and the 19th century, and so a lot of the skills for dealing with these things have been lost, and we need to bring them back. The fourth, and to many people the most important thing, is that we need new drugs. The problem with antibiotics is that antibiotics become less useful the more you use them. So public health officials, quite understandably, don't want to use them very much. They're also far cheaper than cancer drugs or most other types of medicine. And so when somebody comes up with a new antibiotic, they sell very few of them, and the price is very low. And so you can kind of get a sense of maybe why drug companies have been reluctant to invest in this area when there's far more money to be made investing in other types of drugs. What we've proposed is that we give a lump sum to people who come up with a new useful antibiotic so that they don't get rewarded for selling as much of it as possible, because that perpetuates the problem of resistance, but that they can also make a profit for coming up with a new drug. We need to reduce antibiotic use in agriculture. Huge amounts of antibiotics are used in agriculture. In the United States, 70% of medically important antibiotics are used on farms. We also have a problem where we dump antibiotics into rivers and lakes, and this gets into the food system and into the water we drink, particularly in low and middle income countries, and increases resistance. We need vaccines and alternatives such as phage, as was just discussed. We need international coalition for action, and as you might have seen, there was a big UN declaration on this on Wednesday, which was very exciting. But we need to come together and create rules, because there's no point Britain or Europe coming up with solutions to antimicrobial resistance if the rest of the world doesn't follow. So we need to work together, because it's an international or transnational problem. We need surveillance, because often we don't know where or what drug-resistant infections are problematic at the moment. We just don't invest in the infrastructure to monitor them properly. And finally, I'll leave Tamar to discuss this in a minute, we need better diagnostics so that doctors know what somebody's sick with and know what drugs can be used to treat them. And that's just kind of a brief overview of what we think the government and governments across the world should do to stop drug-resistant infections. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. Thank you for coming. And I'm going to talk to you about something very exciting, which is the Longitude Prize, the most exciting prize, UK's biggest science prize, and one exactly in that field of rapid diagnostics for drug-resistant infections. So to tell you the story of Longitude, I have to start a long time ago. 300 years ago, in fact, in 1714, the big problem of the age was knowing where you were when you were at sea. You could quite easily determine your latitude, your north and south, but you couldn't determine your longitude, your east and west. And this was causing ships to crash and sailors to lose their lives. And importantly, it was holding back global trade for Britain. And so, it had been looking to the stars for a long time, expecting astronomy to really solve this problem, but it hadn't. So it decided to try something new, to throw out the challenge to the wider science community, to offer the prize of £20,000, and to see if someone else could solve it. And it was solved by the creation of this beautiful object called H4, the marine chronometer. And that was invented by a gentleman called John Harrison, who was a carpenter, but part-time, he was a watchmaker. And what this showed to the British government and to others was that science inventions don't always come from famous inventors or innovators. And they don't always come from the areas of science that you might imagine. And so if you challenge the world to think about things in different ways, you might find different solutions. So 300 years later, our amazing Astronomer Royal of today, Lord Martin Rees, who was talking at New Scientist Live this weekend, thought, what a great opportunity, 300-year anniversary. Let's see if we can find an equivalent global problem and challenge the world to solve it. And so he brought together a committee of expert scientists, and they talked to the public, and they came up with six potential topics, these topics. And in 2014, some of you may have voted for one of these to be the topic for the new Longitude Prize. It was put out on the Horizon program on BBC. And antibiotics was chosen after 100,000 votes were cast, which is incredible. So the topic the public wanted to focus on was antibiotic resistance. And that's a really huge topic. As you've heard from Anthony, there are many aspects of this issue. And so which bit would fit best with the prize? Well, prizes work best when certain criteria come together. So one of those is, because a prize needs a lot of noise, a lot of media attention, a lot of profile, it often works well when it's something that people will really care about. So the topic has some kind of impact on society. It also needs to have some kind of incentive for innovators. So there needs to be some market for that product or service. And the public needs to be interested in what that is as well. There needs to be the potential of this to broaden out innovation. So prizes work when lots of different people start looking at the problem from different directions. So it needs to be something that can be applied in various ways. It also needs to be something you can judge and you can find a winner for. And so this was the final, I suppose, description of the Longitude Prize. It's a prize that lasts for up to 5 years. There's a £10 million fund. There can only be one winner, and they will receive £8 million. Now, the vision for the prize, we need to significantly reduce the misuse or overuse of antibiotics, because by doing that, we think that we'll tackle antibiotic resistance. And how do we do that? Well, we ask teams around the world to put together and develop a new diagnostic test. So a test that's accurate, that's affordable, that can be used anywhere in the world, in any health system. So in a system like ours, where it's either you have antibiotics through hospitals or your GP surgery, but also in countries where healthcare is provided through community nurses and practitioners, and also in countries where you go to a pharmacist and you can buy antibiotics over the counter. And so this test has to be usable in all of those settings. So it can't rely on a plug-in power source or cold store, needs to be stable, something handheld, something easy to understand. And the most important criteria, it needs to give you your results within 30 minutes. So it's a pretty hard challenge. Now, who runs the prize? So prize is run by a number of different people. The overall committee govern the prize, and that's chaired by Lord Martin Rees and a number of others. The prize advisory panel judge the entries that come to the prize. And then we have a team that run the prize day to day. The journey to win the prize, well, it starts with an idea. If you have an idea, you go to the Longitude Prize website and you register. Once registered, every 4 months you have a chance to win. To win the prize, you need to have a design lot prototype, a business plan, and the technical information about your diagnostic. So far, we have 205 teams working on entries to win the prize in 39 countries. And they're very different. So this slide shows you just a snapshot of some of the different disciplines that are involved in the prize. So by no means are these people that are working in diagnostics already. We've got physicists, we've got engineers, we've got social scientists, we have economists, all sorts of different people from different backgrounds are coming together from industry, from academia, and just have an interest in this topic.
Okay, I'm just going to start chairing the panel discussion now. So I'm going to draw on the expertise and knowledge of the experts that we have here on the stage to try and hopefully answer some of the questions that I think you in the audience might have about this really important topic. So one of the things that I think is really important to talk about just now is that this whole doomsday scenario thing that we've got going on here now. Everywhere you look, there seems to be this whole feeling that we've got something really ominous and scary coming up behind us, and that there's absolutely nothing that we can do to prevent it unless we start putting in loads of money and getting people on board really quickly. So antibiotics and doing the research and rapid diagnostics is the way that we're suggesting could go forward. But I actually wonder whether we should be going back and learning from the past, Caroline. What do you think about that?
Well, I think there are important public health lessons to learn from the past. For example, we know that good sanitation improved infectious diseases, and we know that immunization has helped prevent. Now, for a lot of these organisms, we can't immunize people against them because they are core parts of our healthy gut flora. So we can't immunize people against all E. coli because we need E. coli for healthy function. But there are things we can do. And Anthony mentioned the problem with agricultural antibiotic use. So we have much less antibiotic use in farm animals in Europe than we used to, but we need to actually maintain this level of restriction. And as well as not putting antibiotics into our food chain, because if we put antibiotics into the food chain, then we can pick up the resistant organisms that will be carried by the animals. We need to actually look at agricultural runoff into our drinking water systems. So we need clear separation of agricultural organisms from the human food chain and from our clean water supply. So I think that's very important. There's also things which are more, if you like, public health from the public information, public education side of things. we know, I think all of us in the room here have probably seen and heard the message about don't have antibiotics for a cold. That needs to be reinforced. And we need to make sure that all our health professionals are up to speed, both in hospitals and in the community, with preventing these organisms spreading from patient to patient. So I think, yes, public health, infection control, public understanding, public education are very important keys. Because if we can prevent these infections from spreading, if we can prevent them from happening in the first place, then we won't have to start throwing ever more antibiotics after the problem.
So that's quite interesting, because what you seem to be saying that it's actually not just the scientists or the economists who are part of the solution, but actually it's everybody. So everybody here in the room is part of the solution to this problem?
Absolutely. I mean, we're all responsible for our own health. And I think we're all very well of sort of lifestyle diseases. We all know about what happens with smoking. We all know about the dangers of obesity. We all know about the dangers of diabetes. So we're all responsible in some way for our health. And adapting our behavior to prevent us from getting these infections is very important.
Okay. Thank you.
Can I add a bit to that? Yep. Just to say, I think in our team at Longitude Prize, we do quite a lot on awareness. And we did some surveys. We do them annually, and we do these surveys to understand, really, what's the awareness amongst the UK population of when you need antibiotics and when you don't, what resistance really means, what our behaviours are like. And last year, we found that 38% of the public still don't quite know that antibiotics are only effective for bacterial infections. So some people think they're effective for both bacteria and viruses. Some people think just viruses, and some people think neither. And that's a really important message. We really need to make sure people know exactly when they should be taking them. And I think, as well as maybe pressurizing clinicians that we know, you know, can happen, we can also buy antibiotics over the counter on the internet. We can share them. We can hoard them for the next time we're sick. I think it's some of those behaviors that need to change. And one of the things that we're doing at the Longitude Prize is, as part of our survey, we uncovered the fact that as you get younger in the UK, the likelihood is your behaviours are a little bit worse and that your knowledge is maybe a little bit less. So we started this amazing game called the Superbugs game, which is aimed at 11 to 16-year-olds and is really trying to tell them the message about how bacteria are linked to antibiotics and what superbugs are and how we can prevent them. And I think those sorts of really interactive messages and fun messages and educational messages are really important alongside the standard public health messages. So we get as many people as possible talking about this, thinking about this, and acting, you know, in ways that we can really preserve our antibiotics.
I think that's really important because the message has to get out there. We have to have awareness happening all the time about antibiotic resistance. And I think one of the things this week that antibiotic resistance has hit the news again because of the work that seems to be happening with the United Nations. So it's not just David Cameron's government who saw this as being a problem, but it seems to have gone national. So I guess what I'd say is, where next, really? So you've come up with this report, Anthony. Do you think the UN's actually going to start doing anything with it now, or is it just going to be another report-writing exercise?
So, first of all, yeah, it was really exciting. For those of you who don't follow this as closely as I do, the UN General Assembly on Wednesday passed its fourth ever health declaration. It passed one on HIV, high blood pressure, Ebola, and on Wednesday, it passed one on drug-resistant infections. So in 60 years, we're one of the four times they felt the need to come together and tackle this. And I think, first of all, that's a really good sign. There's a lot of people are interested in this area and have started to realize that it's something that we have to stop. It was the late 80s, early 90s when climate change had that kind of furore about it. And 30 years on, we still haven't done anything to stop climate change. So it's not a home run or an easy win, but it's good that we're there. What's going to happen next is the UN has given countries 2 years to come up with ways to reduce their own use. And it's given itself 2 years to come up with a global system for monitoring everything. So basically, they're taking 2 years to work out what happens next, which sounds annoyingly slow, but is how these things work. And I think it's important that we continue to push so that it doesn't just continue to be a talking point over the next 2 years, or that action gets delayed further and further, but that we get real investment into things like sanitation programs, like diagnostics, and like new drugs, and public awareness campaigns over the next 2 years, and particularly beyond that, that all of our governments come up with really binding solutions.
I find that quite interesting, quite reassuring on one hand, but on the other hand, I'm thinking, climate change, if that's really been the late 80s and the early 90s, we're still in the position at the moment when we have doubters about climate change, and every single 2 or 3 years we seem to have new conferences about climate change. And how much has actually changed? The climate's still changing, and you know, we're still concerned about this. So I think if that's the model that antibiotic resistance is going to be followed, then probably we should still be a bit worried.
I completely agree. I don't think anyone would claim that we've successfully come together on climate change. I think it's a useful thing. Certainly, I've looked at it a lot because it's in some ways it's useful to see what went wrong with climate change. And there's two useful differences between climate change and drug-resistant infection, maybe three. The first is that the problem is much more immediate. So it's not about doing something now to stop something in 30 years' time. It's doing something now to stop something bad happening in 4 or 5 years' time. And that'll encourage people. The second thing is it's probably much cheaper. So the cost of rolling out new drug might be $2 or $3 billion, which sounds like a lot of money, but in terms of 700,000 people dying a year already, that's very cheap in medical terms. So the costs are quite low. Sanitation programs are more expensive, but they're still, you know, you're talking low billions or tens of billions for the whole world, which is the type of money we have and is very different from the much larger amounts of money that are needed to invest in green energy. And the third thing is that there's far less people who have an incentive to dispute drug-resistant infections. Except in agriculture, there's no big industry who loses out by us tackling drug-resistant infections. And that seems to be the thing that constantly undermined that and the high cost that undermined the climate change. So I think we don't have to be as negative as looking at climate change, but it is a cautionary tale.
The other thing that I was wondering too is you had a couple of slides that looked at how this issue is affecting different aspects or parts of the world. So my question to you is that actually it seems to me that the parts of the world where it's going to be most big a problem are the poorer parts of the world, the developing nations. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Because I think lots of people sitting here will probably go, well, if it's a big problem somewhere else, do we really need to be worrying about it here?
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. Yes, we do is the answer, because while it might be a lot worse in India, it's still going to be pretty terrible here. So we roughly have 3,000 or 4,000 people die a year from this already in the UK. If that goes up to 30,000 or 40,000 or moves, because at the moment it's mostly people towards the end of their lives anyway, but if it moves into children, pneumonia gets worse, then you will really start to notice it in the UK. Just like everybody noticed and was terrified about MRSA 10 or 15 years ago, it sadly will be worse in the poorest parts of the world because they don't have the sanitation and infrastructure that we have, and they don't have as good a healthcare system as we have, and often people live much closer together. But it's still going to be a huge problem here.
Caroline, do you want to say something here?
I think it's very important to remember with increasing global travel, what happens in the other parts of the world soon ends up in our backyard too. I'm sure we all remember swine flu a few years ago. Yes, that started off in a quite rural part of Mexico, but it had very soon spread all over the world, including the UK. If we look at the moment at, there's a respiratory virus called Middle East Respiratory Syndrome virus, MERS-CoV.
That is predominantly, as you might expect, in the Middle East, but we've had cases in this country too. So diseases don't stay where they start. Resistant organisms don't stay where they arise. They travel the world. And a lot of the multiple resistant organisms we've seen in clinical practice recently have originated in India, in other parts of the world, in China, and they've ended up here. So we can't just say that's somebody else's problem. That problem is going to pitch up on our doorstep sooner or later.
Okay, so the Longitude Prize, have you got any solutions to on a global scale, do you think, or are we talking? So you said you wanted to get something that could be used all over the world. Are you hopeful? Are you optimistic about this?
Very, very optimistic. So, yeah, the Longitude Prize is really looking for something that's... And I normally take out my mobile phone when I talk about the prize. And I talk about the dream scenario. You wake up one morning, you have some symptoms, you're not quite sure what's wrong with you. You pick up your mobile phone, you breathe into it, or you do a swab, and within half an hour, you get a text message to say you have a viral infection, you don't need antibiotics. What we're looking for is that dream scenario. We're not looking for something that's slightly better than an existing culture test. That's why it's so hard. And having that sort of test, with the prize, to win the prize, it has to work in the most harsh environment. So it has to be the sort of test that anyone without clinical knowledge can use. No power source, no cold store. Has to be internally calibrated. So we're thinking of something like a pregnancy test or something like a smartphone adapter that can plug in. Now, if that test can work in the harshest parts of the world, then it can work in our, you know, very luxurious hospitals. It can work in our primary care clinics. It can work in our other health environments in other countries. So yes, we are targeting the prize at very much the global solution to this diagnostic problem. And the hope is that, as speakers have said, you know, bugs do move. But these bacteria which become infection travel the world with all of us. And when last year we started to see the first totally resistant bacteria, we saw them in India, we saw them in China, we saw one in the US. They're everywhere. They're not just in certain pockets of the world. And I think this test would really help us because it means that then we really are only using the antibiotics when we really need to use them. So in terms of optimism for the prize, well, these 205 teams are doing well. We've got all sorts of tests. We've got breathalyzer tests. We've got gene-based tests. We've got pinbrick tests. We've got smartphone plugins. All sorts of different targets of infection, all sorts of different looks of fields of tests, and from teams all over the world. And I personally think we will see a winner. We've got 3 years of the prize to run. There's still plenty of time. So if any of you have an idea, you should get together with some more people, form a team, and have a go. But I really do think there's so much momentum that's been building for the last 5 or 6 years towards this that I think we will find tests. I think there are more funds being started all the time for drug discovery. I think we will, we're in a good position to see this change in the next few years if we all do our bit.
Are you not worried, though, that the whole aspect of trying to solve this problem has moved out of pharmaceutical companies who've decided that they don't want to invest in this anymore and that we're having to sort of rely on, I mean, the money that you got for your prize, is it from charity money?
It's half from the UK innovation charity, Nesta, and half from the UK government.
Okay.
And I think ultimately the problem of drug-resistant infections is about all of us. It's about all of us using them when we don't need them. That's the crux of the problem. So I don't know if the pharmaceutical industry constantly producing new antibiotics would solve the problem if we just use the new ones badly. Because as new antibiotics have come to market since the time when we saw penicillin, what we've seen is that as each new class of antibiotics comes, it's quicker and quicker that resistance starts to be seen. And so the more new ones we have, the more this is going to continue to be a problem. We do really need to all think about what we can do, because if behaviors change from patients, from clinicians, then resistance will come down. And then, yes, there should be pressure to find new antibiotics.
Okay. Yep.
Can I just add to that? Antibiotics, there's probably a scientific limit to the number of good antibiotics we can get. So the first antibiotic, for those who aren't aware, either blew in the window or fell off the roof was a piece of mold into a Petri dish, which Alexander Fleming realized produced penicillin, which was killing Staph aureus, the bug that was in the Petri dish that he'd forgot to put the lid on. And after 15 years, we turned this into a drug, and it's still probably the biggest, the best drug we've ever come up with, and still probably the best antibiotic we've ever had. And almost all of our antibiotics come from the wild, where fungus or other microbes have come up with an antibiotic to kill bacteria that are involved in their lives. And there's probably a limit to the number of antibiotics that exist in soil, where almost all of our antibiotics have come from. So we can't just rely on pharmaceutical industry, even if they did invest more in this, to continue to churn out more and more antibiotics, because there's probably a scientific limit, which is why it's so important that we look at diagnostics and other things that will reduce unnecessary use and slow down the buildup of resistance.
So I think one of the messages that we're getting here is it's quite a multifaceted problem, and there's not just one solution. Solutions have to be happening on lots of different fronts in order to ameliorate that that slide you had where in 2050 we're going to be losing all these people to antibiotic resistance. Yeah. And we shouldn't just be relying on the doctors to stop prescribing, it's fair to say. We should be looking to the pharmaceutical industry to start thinking about getting better antibiotics and to invest in production, but we need to understand that they have an economic model that they have to do that investment. That we have prizes to look for better diagnostics, because that's one way of looking after our antibiotics better. And we need to do that, because there's no point pharmaceutical companies creating new antibiotics that get sent through trials to go to market for you to use, doctors like you, Caroline, if then we're not looking after them properly when we get them. So we've got to have better diagnostics. And we have to rely on members of the public to understand that these are an absolutely precious resource that we need to look after, and that we're all responsible for that. Does that sum it up about right? Is that where we are today?
Yeah, I think that's roughly where we are today. And I think everyone knows where we are today. And except in agriculture, everyone agrees that those are the steps that need to be taken, because there's nobody who's really against stopping people dying from drug-resistant infections. There's no entrenched interests outside of that space. It's just about actually doing the hard thing, which is raising the money and implementing the new system so that doctors or people don't give out antibiotics over the counter and people don't give them out for the flu, that creating the diagnostics. So like the roadmap, I think, is kind of there. It's about implementation.
And we're all agreed that actually implementation is starting to happen.
I mean, I was going to say, over the last, so since 2014, what we've noticed with the prizes, the momentum, the public interest, the media coverage has really been building up. So in 2015, we had the WHO ratifying the Global Action Plan, calling for countries individually to write their own national plans, what they were going to do on antibiotic resistance. And the UK's really led the way in putting this problem on the UK risk register, in setting up funds, multi-million funds, to try and help support what's happening in the UK and beyond. And then culminating in the UN declaration this week. And 25 countries already have a national action plan. And certainly when I was there listening to other countries talk about what they were going to do, they were all discussing the plans that they had in place and what they were going to be working on. So it certainly feels from this perspective that there is this momentum building and that we will see more action.
And I'm just going to feed you in a minute, Caroline, but a scratch can kill. What do you think?
Well, if you're unlucky, a scratch can kill. But as Tamar was saying, technology is kicking in now. Even in our NHS labs, we've got new technology looking for bacterial resistance genes. We can screen people who are at high risk. We can then isolate them, put them in single rooms. We can wear gloves and aprons to stop their organisms jumping from patient to patient. So it is coming in. Things are changing, but we can't be complacent. We've got to maintain our vigilance and keep going on the project.
And I think that's a perfect place to stop this discussion session. So it's just up to me now to thank all my speakers who came here today to share their expertise with you. Thanks for coming and listening. Be inspired, go away, do your bit, because that's what we are asking you to do. So up to you guys as well, okay? AMR is in your hands. Thank you very much.
That's it for this episode. If you like the show, we'd really appreciate it if you could give us a review or some stars on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back next month, but until then, you can find out more about the Society on our website, microbiologysociety.org. We also have a blog, The Microbe Post, and you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook as well. Our show is produced by me, Anand Jagatia. Thanks for listening. See you next time.